Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Litigation Practice Group, was recorded on Thursday, August 25, 2016, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federal Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call, as today we discuss litigation challenging the constitutionality of the CFPB. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We are very pleased to welcome today two experts to our call. We will hear opening remarks from each of about 10 to 15 minutes, then a little bit of back and forth, but as always, questions from the audience. We'll hear first from Gregory Jacob. He is a partner at O'Melveny & Myers right here in Washington, D.C. He'll be followed in opening remarks by Peter Conti Brown. He's assistant professor of legal studies and business ethics at the Wharton School. With that, Mr. Jacob, the floor is yours.
Well, thank you, Dean, and I wanted to thank the Federalist Society for inviting me to join this call and talk about one of my favorite topics, the constitutionality of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. As most of the folks on the phone probably know, the CFPB was created by the Dodd-Frank Act passed in July of 2010 and was created in part based on concerns coming out of the financial crisis that we had too many different agencies regulating things that involved consumer financial protection, and that we needed to consolidate all of those in one place, and that we further needed to make the place that we consolidated much more energetic than the agencies that had previously been regulating consumer finance. And so the novel structure of the CFPB was created. The CFPB is designated an independent agency, meaning that the head of the agency cannot be removed by the president for policy reasons. Only if certain statutorily specified criteria are met can the president remove that person. It is headed by a director, a single director, Richard Cordray. Unlike most independent agencies that we're familiar with that have a multi-member commission structure with a mix of political parties, multiple individuals, requirements for open meetings to resolve things, in part in order to foster the notion, again, of energetic enforcement in this area, all power within the agency was consolidated into that single director, Richard Cordray. And in addition to that, the CFPB was given a very unusual financing structure. Unlike most agencies, although not all, most agencies receive all of their budget through regular appropriations from Congress. The CFPB does not. The CFPB instead gets to designate a specified percentage of the Federal Reserve's budget in any given year, and it just takes that amount of money for itself. And in fact, not only does it sort of self-fund in this way, but the Congressional Appropriation Committees that would normally have had jurisdiction over an agency such as the CFPB's financing are prohibited by law from inquiring into the CFPB's spending. Now, I should note that hasn't stopped congressional committees from hauling the CFPB up for questioning on a variety of topics, not the committees that are forbidden by law to do it, but others. But it is a very unusual structure, in fact, unique to have that kind of provision in the law, freeing the CFPB from normal constraints. So the reason that I'm on this call talking about this subject is there have been a couple of significant lawsuits filed attacking the constitutionality of this novel structure on the grounds that it violates separation of powers. And the notice that went out about this talk talks about the PHH case, the case that I filed against the CFPB on behalf of State National Bank of Big Spring, which is a small community bank in Texas, as well as the Competitive Enterprise Institute and the 60 Plus Association. I was actually the first of the lawsuits filed in this vein, but we had to take a little detour. Judge Huvel initially determined that none of my clients had standing to question the CFPB's constitutionality. The D.C. Circuit unanimously reversed her, and so we are back in the district court with summary judgment motions pending, and Judge Huvel recently let us know she, in fact, will not be deciding the question of the constitutionality of the CFPB's structure until she gets more guidance from the D.C. Circuit because of the goings-on in the PHH case. The PHH case was filed because of an actual enforcement action brought by the CFPB against PHH. And the details of exactly what the enforcement action are not generally relevant, although they are, in my view, indicative of the problems when you pull away the checks and balances that usually help guide and constrain the way that an independent agency can work. The PHH case involved allegations that PHH was involved in an illegal reinsurance scheme. In fact, the way that PHH had structured its mortgage reinsurance had been based on guidance put out by the Department of Housing and Urban Development, HUD, that had existed, that guidance had been in place for a good 15 years before the powers that HUD previously had in that area, along with the powers of a whole bunch of other agencies, all got consolidated into the CFPB, again, as part of that overarching consolidation that Congress wanted to have. So Congress put all those powers into the CFPB. The CFPB announced at its inception, hey, to the extent that agencies have issued guidance on authorities that they used to have, that we now have, consider them to be in effect until such time as we announce otherwise. What happened to PHH was the CFPB filed an action attacking its reinsurance scheme. Well, it didn't file it. It brought administrative charges against it. There was a determination before an ALJ that purported to rely on the old HUD guidance and assessed about $6 million in fines. That got appealed, and the appeal was to Director Cordray. Director Cordray decided to unilaterally reverse the 15 years of HUD guidance, decided that the three-year statute of limitations that applied to filing the kind of RESPA action that was at issue there simply didn't apply to him because he wasn't filing a lawsuit. He was just proceeding administratively. So the three-year statute of limitations could just be set aside. And he ended up increasing by 18-fold from about $6 million to about $109 million, the penalty that was assessed against PHH. A panel of the D.C. Circuit stepped in and enjoined that action, and a different panel with judges Kavanaugh, Randolph, and Karen Henderson got the merits of that case, and shortly before argument was to be heard, PHH primarily raised their case on the grounds that the way that CFPB has proceeded here is statutorily problematic. They've departed from longstanding guidance. They've blown the statute of limitations, et cetera. But they did raise a constitutional argument mirroring the one that State National Bank of Big Spring had raised, attacking its constitutionality. And the panel made it clear a couple of weeks ahead of argument that it was very interested in hearing about the constitutional issues and that counsel should be prepared to discuss them. So let me briefly talk about, or not briefly, let me talk about the reasons that I think that the CFPB's novel structure is unconstitutional. What we see in the CFPB are a number of features which, while in isolation, may exist elsewhere. When you put them all together, strip away every check and balance that one might have on an independent agency other than the judiciary. Of course, the judiciary still backstops being able to step in, you know, millions of dollars of litigation down the road and determine that something an agency was done wrongly. But we've never thought that that was sufficient in and of itself. Just judiciary will be a check to set aside other separation of powers concerns that we might have. As I noted, the head of the agency is not subject to removal by the president for policy reasons, so the president does not serve as a check on the CFPB. Congress does not have the power of the purse check on the CFPB that Congress typically exerts over agencies. There is no multi-member commission structure. It's just one individual. So we don't have the kinds of mitigating checks and balances that we have frequently seen have been put into place. In fact, Judge Kavanaugh at the hearing pretty strongly telegraphed his view that he thought that the absence of a multi-member commission structure, on top of all these other features at least, was very problematic for the CFPB. My view is you don't take a slice the baloney approach to doing separation of powers issues. When the Supreme Court in the Peekaboo case, Free Enterprise Fund, struck down the novel two layers of removal protection as being unconstitutional there, one of the things it noted was, you know, when you add on to features that might have been okay in isolation, but you put in a novel twist to them, it might not be okay anymore. And that's what the CFPB represents. Truly what Congress has created here is Leviathan. This thing can go on existing in perpetuity all by itself. It never has to go to Congress to get a single dollar of its money. It never has to go to the president for anything because it's insulated from protection by the president. They have created a mini president of consumer finance with no congressional check, no internal check that you might get from a multi-member commission structure where at least you have, you know, actions being taken through open hearings. There's debate between the members that people can have insight into. None of that is there. And there just isn't another example of an agency that has this perpetual structure where it can continuously self-perpetuate with no internal checks and balances of its own and no check from a politically elected president. Those are the features that we think make it unconstitutional. We think that PHH is a perfect example of you know, problematic action that we just don't think that you would see in a properly constituted multi-member commission that had different powers. And another thing to note in this area, you know, the seminal cases, we think Free Enterprise Fund is very relevant because of its focus on, you know, novel innovations that add on to things that might, when viewed in isolation, be okay. But the primary, you know, removal cases that existed prior to that, Myers is the seminal case back from the 1800s that had struck down problematic removal protections that had been imposed on the president's ability to remove essentially a postmaster general. But then Humphrey's executor in the 50s had approved the FTC's structure with independence from the president, but had done so on many grounds that are distinguishable from what we see in the CFPB. It had talked about the importance of a multi-member, apolitical because you had both parties represented in its structure. It talked about it being primarily quasi-judicial in nature because of its functions and quasi-legislative rather than purely executive. There's no question that the CFPB is all about executing on its version of the law and that it does so directly against the public, which also makes it quite different than the independent counsel that was approved by the Supreme Court in Morrison v. Olson, where you had a relatively limited jurisdictional authority of the independent counsel. Now, I still tend to agree with Justice Scalia, and I wouldn't be surprised if with some of the later experiences that we had with the independent counsel statute, some more justices might not have agreed with him today that even the independent counsel was unconstitutional. But at least it was of relatively limited jurisdiction. It was inward facing within the executive branch. It didn't face the general public. But that's exactly what the CFPB does. What we have here is an agency with expansive regulatory powers, all of those powers that were consolidated from these other agencies, plus a very broad additional grant of authority to go out and identify practices that it deems to be unfair, deceptive, or abusive, anything it considers to be abusive. And, Director Cordray has said, abusive, that's an interesting word. We're not quite sure what it means. We're not going to tell anybody in advance by issuing a regulation as to how we're going to define it, but we'll know it when we see it, and we'll go out and prosecute people, and you'll be able to tell by watching who we prosecute, and you'll figure it out yourselves at some point. So this combination of broad, expansive powers that are public-facing without any of these checks and balances are what in our lawsuits view, and we're pretty confident that that's what the D.C. Circuit will also conclude in the PHH case, although we'll see where it goes from there, render it with insufficient checks and balances. And just one last thing to say before I turn it over to Peter for the opposing point of view, it is not the position of the litigants in either of those cases or my own that consumer financial protection is a bad idea. This is not a question about whether there's a proper role for government to step in and make sure that people are not being defrauded, deceived, et cetera. I think that there is a role for government to do those things, but it's important that we have appropriate checks and balances in the structuring of such an agency to make sure that it's doing its job appropriately. And with that, I will turn it over to Peter.
Well, great. Well, thank you so much to the Federalist Society for having me on this call, and to it's a pleasure and an honor to be with Greg Jacobs, who, as you've just heard, is a real expert in this area. We don't agree on much, Greg and I, and this is only going to make this call and podcast more interesting. So in the 10 to 15 minutes or so that I have, let me talk a little bit about some of the legislative history around what began its life in the House bill as the Consumer Financial Protection Agency, and then why the Republicans in Congress pushed for a bureau. And I didn't misspeak there. This was a Republican idea, not a Democratic one, for the structure that is has been characterized as newfangled, I would say, is idiosyncratic, unquestionably. Then I want to talk about the two constitutional issues. One is there a constitutional problem with the CFPB's insulation from the president through the removal protection? And then two, is there a constitutional problem in the insulation from Congress in being essentially off the books outside of the general appropriations process? Then again, I might have to speak quickly to get through all of this, and hopefully some of it will come out of Q&A if I don't have the time. I want to correct where I think some of Greg's characterizations are wide the mark, and then finally conclude by what I think of the real constitutional issue in the separation of powers problem that would be a profound one, and that would be the judiciary legislating and engaging in the fine point needlework of institutional design if they accepted the litigants' claims constitutionally, and why I think that's so troubling. So first, some history. When the House passed its version of what became Dodd-Frank, it included a title that created this agency, and that the Consumer Financial Protection Agency. And it looked a lot like the kinds of agencies that Judge Kavanaugh and Greg and many, many others, the CFPB's critics, like and would have preferred. Of course, at the time, the House was controlled by the Democrats. When the bill came to the Senate, Republicans were aghast at the idea of creating this superstructure independent agency to look like all of the other commissions that so many on the right had hated. And so the idea came from a Republican senator, Senator Corker of Tennessee, that let's do something different. Let's try something different. Let's put it inside the Fed. But we don't want it dominated by the Fed, so we'll make it a sub-bureau of the Fed. So we won't have it an agency at all. It'll still be accountable to the president and to the Congress because it would have to conform to the Appointments Clause of the Constitution, the presidential appointment with Senate confirmation. But a lot of the Democrats balked at this idea, saw that as too cozy to the very regulators who had mucked up consumer financial protection so profoundly in the decades prior. But this was the stuff of compromise. Senator Shelby was on board with this new structure. He saw it as closer to control than what a CFPA would be, and so it was endorsed. Now, the budgetary aspect was a Democratic idea, and that idea was so that it couldn't be gutted the way that the SEC enforcement had been gutted in the decade or two prior to the financial crisis. So that was a new development. Why is that history important? I think history is important because we don't want to fall into a revisionism that says that this was from the beginning, it was bureaucratized in such a way as to maximize insulation. The very opposite is true, and that historical point is often lost in the more recent debates about constitutionality or desirability about the CFPB. And I take Greg absolutely his word that this is not, their litigation is not about trying to delegitimize consumer financial protection. But many people who do criticize the CFPB are engaged in exactly that enterprise. So there's that history. So then the presidential question. Now, Judge Kavanaugh of the D.C. Circuit would go whole hog. Now, the Myers case wasn't from the 1800s. That was 1926. And it's important because the Chief Justice who wrote the opinion was former President William Howard Taft. The only man to have the unique insight of being both president and a Supreme Court justice. And the Myers case looks like it's saying that any kind of removability protection is unconstitutional. The Constitution, of course, is silent on the question of whether Congress can restrict the president's ability to fire any member of the executive branch. But the Myers court filled in that silence by saying, actually, as far as the Postmaster General is concerned, that Congress can't so tie the president's hands. But, of course, that was repudiated during the Roosevelt administration with Humphrey's executor. Judge Kavanaugh thinks that Humphrey's executor got it wrong, Myers got it right, and we should just overturn Humphrey's executor and not see any of these kinds of removability protections at all. Now, that is not what the Supreme Court held in 2010. That single-level removability protection is still permissible. And that really has to be, of course, the argument that wins on the president's side, that there can't be any such protections anywhere through the executive branch, whether we're talking about the CFPB or others. Now, Greg said that his independent counsel is functioning separately. I'm not convinced that these differences are really carry much weight. So what one characterization of Greg's that I would correct is say just because the president can't fire at will within the 5-year term doesn't mean that the institution continues in perpetuity roaming as the headless fourth branch. There are many ways that the president can influence CFPB policy, most of which are informal, but here's the very most important formal way. Choosing the director in the first place. This is a time when President and Congress get together, and the history of the CFPB, of course, whether we're talking about Elizabeth Warren, who didn't get picked because of congressional opposition, prompting her Senate campaign, or Raj Date, who didn't get picked because of opposition, or Richard Cordray, who initially didn't get picked, causing almost a constitutional crisis that's resolved at the Supreme Court through Noel Canning. That looks to me like politics in the best sense, trying to control the agenda of the CFPB exactly as Congress designed it. So that's not insulation from politics. That's blunt exposure to it. So then the question of the appropriations process. Now here I think, I'm frankly confused by the idea that the president can't, there's no political accountability to the president to the CFPB because of that appointment process. I've written elsewhere about other parts of the administrative state, namely the Federal Reserve banks, where the president and Congress don't participate in those appointments. Those trouble me. This one doesn't, because we have, again, every 5 years, this epic debate about what the CFPB should be, what its agenda should be, and who should lead it. And that's exactly as the Constitution was designed to do, and that, again, is politics at its best. So what about appropriations? That's different. It's different but not unique, and here's another place where I think Greg has mischaracterized it. Of course, the CFPB doesn't set its budget. That's incorrect. Congress set CFPB's budget. They wrote it down in the statute. It was 11% of the Federal Reserve's budget the first year of its existence, moved to 12% the year after, and then 13%. I might be off by one. I think maybe it's 10, 11, 12, and then 12 in perpetuity thereafter. So The CFPB has absolutely no control over its budget. It just gets a chunk of what the Federal Reserve System generates through its operation of the printing press and the U.S. seigniorage through its open market operations. So the CFPB is not as powerful from a budgetary perspective as its patron, the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve literally funds itself with money that it creates out of nothing. So if the CFPB is unconstitutionally insulated, then so too is the Fed. And so too is the Office for Financial Research, which is funded identically to the CFPB. And so too would be the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, which is not funded through appropriations, but is funded through insurance premia paid by regulated banks. And so too would be Social Security and Medicaid. What about the interest on debt? These are other things that are off of the balance sheet, so to speak, don't go through the congressional appropriation process. So by my lights, the argument that the CFPB is unconstitutionally insulated from Congress because of its unusual, though not unique, funding mechanism is an argument that there can be no non-appropriated money used in government. I'm guessing Greg disagrees with that idea, but I think the daylight between those is actually pretty thin. And of course, some people make exactly that argument. We've had arguments that Social Security is unconstitutional for exactly this reason, since Social Security was passed in 1935. So is that the argument? Because if so, that's a pretty radical departure for the way things have been since the 30s. So the idea that the CFPB exists in perpetuity is another head-scratcher to me. Every 5 years, we've got to have a new appointment. And more to the point, Congress can eliminate the CFPB just by passing legislation. It doesn't have constitutional status. Congress can do anything it wants to with it. So by tweaking it in small ways or in large ways, so it doesn't exist in perpetuity. And even short of legislation, we've got this mechanism of every 5 years having a politicized and political debate about what the CFPB is and should be baked in. So that leaves, and I've even got a few minutes, so that leaves this question then of what I view as the real constitutional problem with the litigants' challenge to the CFPB's constitutionality. By Greg's characterization, I think he's correctly characterized Chief Justice Roberts' opinion in Peekaboo, that there's no switch here that flips red or green with a constitutional institutional design or unconstitutional institutional design. That's the argument, but it's additive. The problem with that is that it invites judicial meddling in a way that says, well, these kinds of structures are and these kinds of structures aren't, and when you add up these 4 out of the 11 but these 6 out of the 11 don't, what does that sound like? Well, that's institutional design. That's legislation. That's making law. That's not determining whether the separation of powers principles are respected. That's getting into the nitty-gritty grunt work of trying to create these institutions in the first place. Now, the counter to that might simply be, well, actually, look what the Supreme Court did in PCOV, in the Peekaboo case, right? They just said, we're going to write this out of the statute. It's severed, and we're going to excise it. The D.C. Circuit has done this very thing a couple of times since then, following Free Enterprise Fund. So what if the Supreme Court does the same thing and removes the removability protection that the director enjoys? Well, I don't think it would make that big a difference, just like I don't think it made a big difference with Peekaboo, right? Remember when the IRS scandal was blowing up? President Obama said, look, I had nothing to do with this, the IRS targeting right-wing nonprofits or anything like that. I had nothing to do with it. The IRS is an independent agency. Well, he misspoke in the sense that the IRS doesn't have any kinds of these institutional protections written in statute. But he certainly didn't misspeak when we think about the political culture surrounding the IRS or the EPA or sometimes different secretaries of state or treasury even, the people we think of as most closely associated with the president. The point is that in institutional design and in removability protection and in insulation, the line between politics and law is quite blurry. So in that sense, I think that the stakes in some way are pretty low on this question. But low they may be, I don't think that I don't think either of the extreme positions that you cannot have removability protection at all, or that you cannot have non-appropriated financing in the government. I don't think those are constitutionally correct. And I don't think it's correct, the parsing that is done, to say, well, in this case, the CFPB, you can't have that. But in other cases, you can. I think that requires some acrobatics intellectually and legally that might be better seen in the lobbies of Congress or in the halls of Congress, better not to be seen in the halls of the judiciary. And I'll turn it back to Dean, I think.
Terrific. Well, thank you both. I want to give Greg Jacob a chance to respond. There's a lot on the table here. Before I do that, let me open the floor to questions. People can begin to queue up. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question, you need to push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for either of our experts or both of our experts, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Mr. Greg Jacob, there's a lot on the table here. I want to give you a couple minutes to respond, but I also want to ask you, I'm not sure if I heard this in your opening remarks or not, and that's the the deference to the judiciary that's required under this act. Does that figure in your argument or in the PHH argument? Does that bolster separation of powers concerns? And also sort of related to that, does the CFPB have an adjudicatory function?
Yeah, so let me address a few points then. One, with respect to the question of judicial deference here. I think properly read, the Dodd-Frank Act gives the CFPB essentially the same kind of Chevron deference authority to the regulations that it issues, the positions that it takes, that other agencies might have. And in and of itself, you know, what one can question under delegation doctrine grounds, some of the circumstances under which that arises. I think for the vast majority of the powers that have been put into the CFPB, it's not inherently problematic to give the agency Chevron type deference with respect to its actions. It is a very, very broad additional authority that has been given with respect to combating, for example, the abusive practices that I mentioned earlier, and I think it's deeply disturbing that the agency has said we're going to do this on an ad hoc basis without letting you know ahead of time, and then we expect the courts just to defer to us in terms of the positions that we've taken in individual cases. The court has been, over the last few years, I think largely due to abuses of the regulatory state that they have seen again and again with agencies taking surprise positions on litigants that they didn't expect before, and that under the court's prior deference doctrine, for example, the 1997 case, Auer v. Robbins, which was highly deferential to a position that the agency took for the first time in litigation. Several of the justices have questioned whether Auer should remain good law at all. But it is troubling to have deference where you have a very broad authority, the agency acting in an ad hoc pattern, and on top of that, no checks and balances behind the scenes in terms of the way that the agency is going to approach the questions put to it. The one aspect of the deference authority that I think is a little bit different is that the courts are expressly instructed. If the president or an executive agency that reports to the president has taken one position under a statute, let's say that both the CFPB and the presidential executive branch both have some jurisdictional authority under a particular statute, and the president says, we think it means X. The CFPB says, we think it means Y. The judiciary is instructed to disregard the president and to adopt the CFPB's position instead. I view that as part and parcel of the problematic separation from the president rather than as a separate deference question. But the notion that the president has to bow to the director of the CFPB in interpreting laws, even laws that are otherwise within the president's authority to interpret and execute, again, I think is part and parcel of the overall unconstitutional structure. A couple of points harkening back to Peter's remarks. One is, you know, Peter does seem to acknowledge that it is important that there be some level of presidential control here. He's satisfied by the notion that we are going to have, as he put it, a national conversation every 5 years. And he also thought that it wouldn't make much difference if you pulled the removal protections out of the statute. I can tell you it would make a big difference anytime you have a change of administrations from one political party to another, because the first thing that a new political administration is going to do is fire the person that was appointed by the other party and put someone in who will pursue the policy agenda that they were just elected to pursue. Now, of course, we could get into questions about, you know, a president may be elected on any number of different policy platforms, and it may not be the case that the majority of the electorate is with him on any given issue, but that's just the way that our system works, right? The president comes in and across all the executive agencies pursues the agenda that the president thinks is best to pursue, and that's the way that we assure some political accountability there. The five-year term can mean that a president has zero opportunity to affect the CFPB and Consumer Financial Protection Law at all. If someone was appointed shortly before a president is elected, they might have absolutely no opportunity. And that does not happen with the multi-member commissions, because the multi-member commissions have rolling appointments. So within a year, year and a half, you always have the opportunity to flip the political structure of that agency and assure that it is enacting policies that are at least consistent with the one chosen by this president. But you could have a complete dry spell under the way this is structured, where there is no opportunity for accountability at all. And moreover, there's a holdover provision. So if you can't get the Senate to agree on someone, and for a long time, as Peter noted, there was no agreement on Cordray until a deal was finally cut, the person who's in there gets to hold over. So that term could, and we've seen how dysfunctional the Senate is, go from 5 years to six, seven, whatever it may be. And in fact, there might be an awful lot of incentive for a recalcitrant group of folks in the Senate to hold a appointment up just so that they can keep control over consumer financial protection law through, for example, keeping Cordray in there if a Republican administration were to come in. The one other thing that I wanted to comment on, and actually I'll then throw a question back to Peter, is the Federal Reserve and the notion of these self-funding agencies. It is true that the CFPB is not the only agency out there that derives its funding from sources other than congressional appropriations. We all learned this, for example, when Congress was incensed about the Obama executive orders, or really executive policies on immigration, and tried to turn around and say, well, that's fine, we'll just put an appropriations rider in and defund Customs and Immigration Services. Well, sorry, Congress, you can't do that, because they get all of their funds from the fees that they generate from the applications that they put out. So Congress was not able to impose a check there. So it is a problem that exists elsewhere. But what you see in those other agencies is they typically have a regulated community that they're deriving most of their funding from. CIS is one example of that, so that you at least have some interaction between the regulator that's deriving its funding from the community that it's servicing, and thus there has to be sort of a interplay between those. The other thing that I'll say is it just cannot be the case that, I mean, we all know, it's Civics 101, Congress's primary ability to provide a check and balance in our system is the power of the purse. The president has the sword, Congress has the purse. It cannot be the case that Congress could just write a blank check to the president and say, set aside military appropriations because there's some specific constitutional provisions on that, but just say the president may spend as much as, let's say, $10 trillion a year at his discretion. Do whatever you want, and it'll be just fine by us. And so we're just going to give you that blank check. That can't possibly be consistent with our constitutional structure. And yet what they have done here is essentially take an entire cabinet-level agency. That's the kind of power that the CFPB has, and written it that blank check. Now, granted, it's capped. It can't go beyond the very substantial amount of money that it derives from the Federal Reserve's budget, but nobody controls. There's no oversight over the way that money's spent, and it is, again, completely self-perpetuating. The notion that somebody could come along and provide a check on the CFPB by dismantling it down the road ignores the fact that once you've created something, once you've got that structure set up, it's subject to filibuster within the Congress, bicameral agreement between the Senate and the House, and then the president can veto it as well. So neither the president nor the Congress could exert that authority unless there's agreement between the two. And when you look at the amount of time that there has been a split between the sides, it just provides an impetus in favor of inertia between those, inertia in allowing the agency to proceed along as it has. So anyway, with those comments, I guess my question to Peter is, if you really think that the world, if it's not black or white, the courts just shouldn't get into these shades of gray at all. Where is there a line here? What would prevent Congress from doing the same exact thing with the Labor Department, the Department of Housing and Urban Development, the Department of Veteran Affairs, the EPA, just right on down the line, the Treasury Department? Where do you draw the line where the Congress could not both at the same time put in removal protections that prevented the president from removing the person from policy reasons and rendered the agency completely self-funded? Because I don't see how, under the principles that you're espousing, you could prevent that anywhere. Maybe the Defense Department, you would say that the president has a unique constitutional role there, and maybe state as well. But where else would you possibly draw the line that would say, no, you can't have this novel structure?
Before we go back to Professor Conte Brown, let me re-announce that we're in the Q&A session now. If you have a question, you need to push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Our lines are wide open. We have no questions pending. Push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. I suppose we do have a question pending from Greg Jacob to Professor Conte Brown. Where do you draw the line, Professor?
Well, I'm going to reveal my hand a bit of being a pretty profound judicial skeptic on some of that. Where would I draw the line? I think that question is important if I'm putting on my hat as a legislator versus a judge. As a legislator, I may well say this is way too much. Non-appropriated agencies have no place. We shouldn't have that. And let's be clear, though, Greg is not correct in noting that the Fed, while it does derive some of its income from charge services, 75% of its funding, vast majority of what it uses to keep its lights on and pay its employees and provide them with retirement and the like, comes from exactly this kind of budgetary autonomy. But even greater than that, because they actually create the money with which they fund themselves. The FDIC is also different. It's not that they're getting charged services. It's that they have to fund the insurance fund, the deposit insurance fund, and then the FDIC gets to skim off the top to fund itself. So it's very different from the Comptroller of the Currency or Customs or others that are on a fee-based, application-based based system. So as a legislator, where would I draw the line? I think that's exactly the question of why politics is so important. And the very mechanisms of institutional design that make Greg uncomfortable, bicameral legislation, a veto, that's the Constitution. That's what our Constitution is. It was built to create exactly that kind of inertia, to make legislating difficult. And so if we're uncomfortable with that, then we're uncomfortable with the constitutional order. And that's very clear. So where would I draw the line? I would say the legislation really does have to come through a bicameral process subject to veto. Quasi-legislation, quasi-judicial power, I'm okay with there being independent agencies writ large. And so there I would say, as a judge, where would I draw the line would be so much higher. It would say, whatever my tastes as a senator, as a member of Congress, or as a citizen are, the judiciary just isn't in the business of doing nitty-gritty institutional design. And so that's where I get more uncomfortable. One place where I, as a judge, would feel very comfortable is saying, if Congress created an agency appointed by the regulated entities. So for CFPB, we're going to say, and it can be on either side of the V for litigation arising out of these regulations. So if CFPB is going to be appointed by a committee of public interest lawyers and then to serve, you know, whatever term, I would say, well, it violates the appointments clause of the Constitution. That's unconstitutional. Separation of powers, I think, is so much more difficult. And I'm not saying that I would never see a separation of powers problem. I think it would take a huge amount of insulation before I felt as a judge comfortable with the other side of that coin, the other side of the separation of powers problems, with the judiciary inserting itself too profoundly in the legislative process.
Once again, this is Dean. If you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We still don't have any questions, an unusually reticent audience. Let me ask maybe a question of, well, now suddenly we have three questions, so I will defer, as it were, to our audience. Let's take our first question.
Other federal agencies that have a great deal of self-funding would be the FDA, which is funded by the examination of various drugs, and the Patent Office, which is funded by patent examination. I don't know how that affects your argument.
I assume that it's me, Greg, who you're asking how it affects the argument. Yeah, we have a list of agencies that are self-funded. It's not unique to see that there. And again, that's in part why we think it's important that rather than take this, you know, narrowly siloed approach and saying, is it okay just to do this? Is it okay just to do that? If you look, the Fed has a board of governors with geographic diversity built in. It has internal checks and balances of the kind that the Supreme Court endorsed in Humphrey's executor and that, frankly, would make Judge Kavanaugh more comfortable. The same is true when you look at virtually all of these other agencies, that you have other mitigating protections in place. Here, the problem is that with the CFPB, you have no accountability to the president, no accountability to Congress, and none of the mitigating internal checks and balances that we've seen established in other places. And so, you know, I do think that there are, that it is worth a real close examination of, you know, where the ability to create funding mechanisms entirely outside of the Treasury. The Constitution is quite specific that money can't be withdrawn from the Treasury except through congressional appropriations. So there are serious questions as to what does that mean, that we can just take all of the money that we get in from taxes and everything else and put it in a shoebox instead of in the Treasury, and then we can just spend it however we want to? I think that it's worth seriously examining that question and seeing where lines should be drawn. But what I think is clear here is the combination of all of the stripping away of checks and balances in the CFPB is not what is contemplated by the constitutional structure. I think, you know, Peter keeps holding up the Constitution on this, but I don't think that Peter will find anywhere in the Constitution a reference to the notion of independent agencies. So the Constitution's default presumption is you have either legislative power, executive power, or judicial power. And one of the things that I think that the court made clear in Free Enterprise is that removal protection, which creates an independent agency, is a narrow exception to the general rule, that we recognize that it in and of itself places some real strain on the constitutional structure, which says it is the president who shall execute. It's no question that CFPB is executed. And yet we have allowed not just that addition of removal protection, but the stripping away of all of the other things as well. So when you look at the combination, it's then that you truly see a departure that goes beyond the pale in our view.
You know, I think this is Peter again. I think that Greg is making a very important point here. And that is, and I completely agree with what he said in terms of the Constitution and its vision of what execution means. Now, the Constitution does envision agencies. What it does, it envision independence in those agencies? Well, by naming individuals separate from the president to have different duties, then that seems to suggest envision at least some kind of, even if we're just talking about corporeal separation, independence, there's something there. But my point in agreement with Greg is independent agencies, like we've seen since the beginning of our republic, don't fit comfortably in a black and white reading of the Constitution, right? There is not an article devoted to a fourth branch in that way. And, you know, this is also the place where I'll admit I'm a scholar of central banking and history, much less the Constitution. But from a banking perspective, the function of banking and central banking does look quite different from legislative, executive, or judicial authority. And so then it raises the question, and I think this is what illustrates my discomfort with this litigation attacking the CFPB, is simply a New Deal-era litigation redux, where we've had this conversation, this national conversation, for many, many generations, 80 years at least, and indeed the administrative state goes back to the very first Congress. Is the argument that we cannot have independent agencies? And Greg would say, no, that's not the argument. We got to look at the gestalt of each institution. And I don't think that argument works. I think it is an attack on independent agencies. And a lot of very serious, very smart people in good faith say independent agencies have no place. Judge Kavanaugh is basically one of them. And I think if that's the argument, then let's make it. And if that's the argument, the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve System is not an exception to that. The geographic diversity on the Board of Governors is sort of a joke. I mean, Ben Bernanke was from South Carolina in the sense that he went to high school there. He hadn't lived there in many, many decades, but he got to claim South Carolina to satisfy geographic diversity. And that has been true for the Board of Governors almost throughout its history. You can conveniently claim any kind of geographic diversity. The governors on the Board of Governors have a 14-year term, much longer than five. And then again, I do keep coming back to the Fed's appropriations or its budgetary autonomy, which is unrivaled. And it is a giant to the pygmy of the CFPB. And so if you are going to remove that budgetary autonomy, then we basically need to have a conversation about the end of central bank independence in America. And I just don't think that that's a conversation that most people would be interested in having. And that's why I think that it's hard. If you pick up one end of the stick, you're picking up the entire stick. And I'm not convinced by the arguments that actually we're just talking about some really fine-grained combinations here that are limited to the CFPB that wouldn't have spillover to the way that we run the U.S. bureaucracy and administration and have done for decades and arguably centuries.
Let's take our next call.
So I have a question for Greg. Assuming the court does rule in your favor and your clients win the case, what are the options for remedies for the court? What are you looking for? What do you think the court will do? Is there anything short of declaring the entire agency unconstitutional?
Yeah. Well, you have some historical examples. For example, in Buckley v. Valeo, where the court invalidated, I believe it was a prior version of the FEC, they essentially gave Congress a set amount of time to fix it. Now, in Free Enterprise Fund, the court just struck out the double removal protection that it deemed problematic. But I think that if there are different grounds on which the court could ultimately rule that the CFPB was unconstitutional, let's just say hypothetically that it went the way that Judge Kavanaugh seemed to be telegraphing at the PHH argument and said, look, if you want to have an independent agency, you need to have the mitigating protection of a multi-member commission structure. If it were to say that, I don't think that the court, for all of the reasons that Peter was articulating, would be the right entity to make the decision where either you could remove the removal protections and then you'd be okay because you just have somebody directly accountable to the president, or you could turn it into a multi-member commission structure, and that would be okay as well. If you've got two equally good alternatives, I agree with Peter, you shouldn't be making that choice in the judiciary. Instead, you would say, hey, court, you know, we're striking this down as it exists today, but Congress we're not going to say that all business grinds to a stop today. We'll give you, say, 6 months to enact an alternative structure, and you can make the choice between those options. That's what I think that the proper resolution before the court would be.
Professor, do you have a comment here? Should we take what looks like a final question?
I think Greg covered it well, so let's take the last question.
Good afternoon. This is George Meade in Florida. I'm intrigued by the statement that I forget which gentleman made it, that there is no provision in the Constitution for a fourth branch dealing with execution, and that's not exactly true. There is, in fact, the militia under Section 1, Section 8, Clause 15 and 16, and it's specifically charged with the civil duty of enforcing the laws of the Union. I was wondering if anybody had wrestled with that distinction in Henry Humphrey's Executor, because it did make the distinction between executive functions versus quasi-legislative and quasi-judicial, and I wonder if that is, in the experience of either of the gentlemen, informed this debate.
Did anybody want to take a shot at that first?
Sure. I know I'm not, as I just confessed, and will hide a little bit under my central banking flag again. My research specialty is in central banking, but I think what the gentleman is pointing out is a profound truth. There's a mythology built around the idea of independent agencies that they came in a trickle during the Progressive Era, and the dam broke in the New Deal. And that we've had with us ever since, this headless fourth branch. It's just simply not true. From before the Constitution, and certainly written into the Constitution, the example just offered was about the militia. We see it in with reference to the State Department, Treasury, Postmaster General, and others, that agencies and bureaucracy have been with us as long as we've had government. And so thinking through the flexibility in institutional design that Congress has had as its constitutional prerogative with presidential participation is a core part of our constitutional order. And that's written in the document. And so seeing that kind of separation between president and those that he and Congress and the people select to execute these issues or these policies is an important distinction. You know, there's a professor at Yale Law School, Nicholas Perillo, who's written just a phenomenal book that goes into great detail about all the institutional experimentation that was that existed in the 19th century. His study concludes in 1940, but it was really focusing on the 19th century, in the ways that the government hired people and paid them to execute laws, ways that we would look at right now and just say, that's bad policy, that's bad law, that can't be constitutionally permissible, and yet it was widespread. And so I think my point in seeing this litigation differently from the way that Greg sees it is I would be loath to see the judiciary come in and freeze in amber the idea that there can be no more institutional experimentation and that the appropriate remedy – suppose I was convinced – that Greg is exactly right on the merits of this and the policy idea, that this is too much insulation. This is too much autonomy given to an agency that can turn $1 million fine into a $109 million fine because he was feeling vindictive one morning. Then the appropriate forum for having that argument and winning that argument is a legislative and presidential one, not a judicial one. And that not doing that, passing this over to the judiciary, having the Supreme Court write an amendment themselves through the form of a Supreme Court opinion to the Constitution, saying with ever-increasing footnotes, this kind of structure is okay, that kind of structure is not okay, this is okay, that's not okay. You can have private appropriations, but only for the central bank, unless it's the FDIC. That kind of thing I don't think works. I don't think it's good, and I think that would represent a real challenge to the constitutional order.
Final word from Greg Jacobs. Greg, 60 seconds, if you could.
Sure. No, first of all, I don't think that congressional innovation is a bad thing. I think that there are limits. The limits are spelled out by the Constitution. And the problem here with this agency is the stripping away of all of the protections that we would normally have in place. And again, you cannot look at the CFPB director as anything other than a mini president of consumer finance. He's a president unto himself with his own budget and no accountability to anyone. And I just don't think that that can be reconciled with constitutional separation of powers.
Well, gentlemen, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it right there. My thanks to both of you. This has been an interesting debate and informative as well. A reminder to our audience that our next scheduled telephone conference call is on Monday. We might slip a call in tomorrow, but right now the next scheduled call is not until Monday. But until the next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.